I start by the Jewish word shalom.
I also antagonize a lot of people by recognizing the State of Israel as soon as it was formed. Well, I had been to Potsdam, and I'd seen some of the places where the Jews had been slaughtered by the Nazis.
Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region.
If the world governments do nothing, what will you do?
We'll have to protect ourselves.
How?
We'll see the best way we can.
No Daylight with Rachel Azaria.
So, hi, my dear friend Michael Oren. How are you?
Hello, my dear friend Rachel Azaria. So good to see you.
So good to see you. Yeah, yeah. So we're here talking about towards the Israeli Independence Day. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you to choose which paragraph is your favorite paragraph.
Good. I wouldn't say about my favorite paragraph. I think it's in many ways the most essential paragraph. It's the paragraph that really establishes the right of the Jewish people to self-determination in our ancestral homeland. And it begins in Hebrew.
זכות זו הוקרה בהצהרת בלפור מיום ב' בנובמבר 1917, ואושרה במנדט מטעם חבר הלאומים, אשר נתן במיוחד תוקף בינלאומי לקשר ההיסטורי שבין העם היהודי לבין ארץ ישראל, ולזכות העם היהודי להקים מחדש את ביתו הלאומי.
Fascinating. This right was recognized in the Balfour Declaration of the 2nd of November 1917 and reaffirmed in the mandate of the League of Nations, which in particular gave international sanction to the historic connection between the Jewish people and Eretz Yisrael and to the right of the Jewish people to rebuild its national home. Wow. What's in that? Basically, everything's in that.
Okay.
So let me start off with something that's going to sound self-aggrandizing, but in fact, in view of recent events, it's not. I used to teach it at Harvard and Yale, and I taught a course on this, believe it or not.
You didn't teach in Columbia?
I didn't teach. I'm a graduate of Columbia.
Graduate
I didn't teach
Columbia.
It.
Yeah,
no,
okay.
But I taught a seminar called Zionist Diplomacy from the Balfour Declaration to Oslo. I mentioned this not with any pride because I'm sure I would not be able to teach that same seminar today. That seminar would be burnt. That's the word Zionism in an actual name of a graduate seminar.
Of course.
Seminar. Right,
oh, wow.
A course.
Wow,
right.
Zionism.
So what was interesting, the course started off with a detailed, almost Talmudic study of the Balfour Declaration and in it. And what is the Balfour Declaration says is that there actually is a Jewish people and the Jewish people have an inalienable right to self-determination in their homeland. Now, the Balfour Declaration does not promise us a state. It doesn't promise us a state in all of Eretz Yisrael. It promises us a national home in Eretz Yisrael, which could be like a hotel in Netanya, right?
Yeah,
welcome
right.
to the national home.
Yeah.
You've got there, right? The British have fulfilled their promises. But what it really says is the first time that there's an internationally recognized document that recognizes the existence of a Jewish people, not a Jewish religion,
yeah.
Okay. That's huge. And you put that together with Wilson's points that were the post-war basis of the post-war World War One order.
Yeah,
was
you
want to
say a word about the Wilson's points?
Well, Wilson was they had the 12 points. And one of the 12 points was the right of self-determination for peoples. And so this hooked right into Wilson's 12 points. And this was the basis of the post-World War One order, which found expression in the League of Nations, which later became the United Nations. So here we have, and several years after this, at the San Remo Conference, the Balfour Declaration is taken, and the international community recognizes the Jewish people and its rights to self-determination. They issue a mandate, a British mandate over Palestine, and that mandate then becomes the basis for the 1947 partition resolution in Palestine, which created a Jewish and an Arab state in Palestine. What's very interesting about this is that the 1947 partition resolution does not reiterate the recognition of the Jewish people.
Right.
So basically, the Balfour Declaration represents the high part
right.
of Jewish diplomacy, of Zionist diplomacy, and we've been trying to get back to it ever since, and we've never succeeded. Not in the 1979 Camp David Accords with Egypt. There's no reference to the Jewish people. And not in the Oslo Accords with the PLO of 1993. And I can just say a quick word about it because I was actually an advisor to the Rabin government when this was going on. And I remember looking at the Oslo Accords. And at the end of the Oslo Accords, there's an exchange of letters between then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, where Rabin recognizes the PLO as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. Get it? Israel recognized the existence of a Palestinian people, and Arafat recognized Israel.
But not.
And I remember reading this, and I said, uh-oh, we're in trouble. This is all going to fall apart on this because there's no reciprocity here. Because Israel, you know, especially if millions of Palestinian refugees comes back, it's just a Palestinian state. It's not the Jewish state. And so
that's
for 30
like,
years
that's
after.
Like,
sorry, go ahead.
No, but that's like the continuation of From the River to the Sea.
It is,
it's
certainly.
It's like part of the same thing, basically.
Well, it's denying that there is a Jewish people. The whole Palestinian, in many ways, worldview, and not just a worldview because it finds expression in their actual policy, is to deny that there actually is a Jewish people, that there was never a first temple, there was never a second temple. All the artifacts we dig up are somehow all fabricated. Our whole history is a false history. And why did they do that? Because if they acknowledge that we actually are a people, somehow that derogates from their identity as a people. And I've actually had Palestinian negotiators tell me this, that they can't recognize us as the Jewish state because that means somehow that we're negating our own identity by doing that. They actually say this. And it's interesting that throughout the many negotiations through different governments, and I'm talking about Tzipi Livni, I'm talking about Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, the demand was always that the Palestinians recognize Israel as the Jewish state. You know this from being in government. And sometimes people didn't understand this. I mean, even Barack Obama eventually came around to understanding why this was essential. Because even if you had a two-state solution, one state, the Palestinian state, is legitimate. The other state, the Jewish, the Israeli
is
state,
always
is
under
not.
Threat.
It's going to be irredenta all the time, all right? It's never going to be legitimate. He finally understood this. And I can't tell you how deep this went. When we used to host foreign leaders here, you know, you take them to Yad Vashem. And one of the ceremonies we would request them to do would lay a wreath at the tomb of Herzl on Mount Herzl. Most foreign leaders refuse to do that. Obama agreed to it, but many leaders won't do that because laying a wreath on Herzl's tomb means recognizing the Jewish state, Israel as the Jewish state. Even the Europeans won't do that. They won't. Israel is... The Europeans will say, well, recognizing Israel as a Jewish state is dismissing the Arabs who live in Israel for whom Israel is not the nation state. They will not do that. Only a wreath at Herzl's tomb. So why is this paragraph so essential? This is really the raison d'etre of the Jewish state. And we have not been able to replicate it ever since. We've tried and tried and tried. This was the high point, the Balfour Declaration.
So Weizmann was our best... diplomat? Or that was like the moment, the crystallized moment?
It was a moment. There was a moment, you know, after World War One. There was a different moment after World War II because of the Shoah, because of the Holocaust.
But we couldn't, after the Holocaust, we couldn't reach the same thing.
No, we got a state. We got something that's not in the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah,
okay, the Balfour doesn't talk about a state. Okay?
You're right.
But we didn't get recognition of the right of the Jewish people to self-determination. And even Truman, when he recognized, becomes the first nation on earth to recognize this rebirth Jewish state, wants to call
minutes?
It easy. He calls it Israel. He doesn't call it the Jewish state of Israel. So it's something that goes really to the heart of it all. And even now, what's going on campuses around in the United States and other places, it's the denial. It's people denial. Okay, it's not even Holocaust denial. It's Jewish peoplehood denial. And with Jewish peoplehood denial comes denial of a first a temple and a second temple in Jewish history here. It's very, very deep.
Wow. Okay.
That's why I want that paragraph.
It's a beautiful paragraph. And I have to say altogether that the Declaration of Independence, the first part is like all of the reasons that we deserve the state of Israel, right? And then it goes on to the fact that we're establishing and what kind of state Israel is going to be. And also in the part that we discuss what kind of state Israel is going to be, so there is a moment that in the declaration that they call the United Nations to give a hand to the Jewish people in building our country and accepting the state of Israel into the family of nations. And here again, you can see what you're talking about. They made sure to have the Jewish people in building the country and the state of Israel. So,
well, the whole document is about Jewish peoplehood. It opens up as in the land of Israel, the Jewish people was born.
But they played like, even if in this sentence, they put both of them together. It's not enough just to, you know, to accept the state of Israel, but the Jewish people and the state of Israel. And that's what you're talking about.
Which I think we have a certain amount of buyer's remorse about that paragraph, because it in many ways obligates us to the UN, which is a problem.
You think it's a problem?
So, well, it's a problem because, you know, many people have said to me, and probably to you as well, why don't we leave the UN? I mean, they condemn us. Why not? They condemn us more than twice as frequently as all other nations in the world combined, okay?
Yeah.
Why, you know, we didn't come here to get insulted. Why are we just standing there and letting ourselves be legitimized? Why do we lend legitimacy to an organization which is fundamentally anti-Semitic? My own bit of, I would say, propaganda. I think it's sort of a public stance is that I've always called on American leaders to kick the UN out of New York because it's very good real estate, make a lovely park along the river. But why is New York, one of the great Jewish cities of the world, why is it hosting this fundamentally anti-Semitic organization? And it's incompatible with New York's values, certainly with America's values. Kick it out. Let it go to a place that's a little bit more amenable, like Damascus and Tehran.
You
go there.
Think so?
Yeah. I do. I think the UN is very, very problematic and extremely problematic during this war.
It is very problematic during this war, but the solution, I don't know, the way I think of it is that we need to work to change it. I have to say, maybe it's like I grew up as an Israeli, okay?
Right.
So like 1947, the vote in the UN, it's, you know, that's like, that's our history. And the fact that I think it's probably the only time, someone said there's another time, but the only time that also the Russian part and the American part, the socialistic part or the communism and capitalism both voted yay and one notion was for the establishment of the state of Israel. So like, I don't know, for us, I think the UN, there's something very, like we owe them something. I don't know if we owe, but like we, you know, there's a gratitude towards the UN. And
we
I
don't
think
like
that's
remembering
why,
it sometimes, that's all.
What?
I myself am very ambivalent about whether Israel should stay in the UN or not. I do think the UN should not be in New York, but that's another question. But whether we should stay and fight or just say this is a battle we can't win, and the longer we stay, the more we lose. And these are compelling issues. They're compelling arguments, and I haven't entirely decided which one we should do. Right now, I'm inclined to say, as you do, that we should stay and fight.
Yeah.
I'll give you a more specific example of the UN Human Rights Commission.
Yeah.
Where, again, they condemn Israel more frequently than all other countries in the world combined. There's Article 7 of the UN Human Rights Commission, which empowers, actually instructs the UN Commission to investigate Israel every year for human rights abuse. We're the only country in the world. So George Bush removed America's ambassador from that council once upon a time. President Obama brought him back. Trump took him out again. Biden put him back again. The Democrats' argument was that by having an American ambassador, we can better fight the anti-Semitism. But in fact, the anti-Semitism in any way did not diminish. It just went up. And what the presence of the American ambassador does, I think, is it legitimizes what is fundamentally an anti-Semitic body. And so there's the argument sort of in a nutshell, in a microcosm around the Human Rights Commission. And I still think that the United States should not have an ambassador there, because it just simply legitimizes Jew hatred.
Okay, let's go back to the Declaration of Independence a bit more. So we're towards our Independence Day and the day before we have our Memorial Day.
Right.
And I think that everyone in Israel is trying to figure out, you know, how are we going to handle these days? How harsh will Memorial Day be?
Harsh.
Very harsh.
Very harsh.
Yeah. We had now Pesach, the last day of Pesach, Passover, And there is Yizkor in the shuls. And we have a Yizkor that we do for the soldiers. And it was very hard. It was very hard in all the shuls.
Pesach was challenging. How do you celebrate liberation with 133 Israelis, you know, in horrible captivity?
So we're looking towards these days, trying to think how are they going to be and what are we going to do? And I think that it's a moment that I want to kind of think about it also in with your perspective, with your American perspective. You grew up in the United States, right? Do you remember celebrating Israeli Independence Day?
Not as a young person. As I got to be older and involved with Jewish and Zionist activities, I would go to the parade in New York.
You don't remember celebrating?
I don't remember celebrating.
Where
certainly
did you grow
up? In New Jersey.
New Jersey.
But certainly not Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. And it's Memorial Day is in many ways the only uniquely Israeli day. And it's difficult. It's difficult for American Jews or diaspora Jews to identify with it. I just remember going to a ceremony in Jerusalem some years ago, and some tourists came in the back, and I overheard them say, "Let's sit near the door in case we want to go out early." And I'm thinking, they don't get it.
They can't get it.
It's too difficult for them. And though the Yom HaShoah is a much profounder experience in the United States, and they really do mark the Holocaust Memorial Day in a very solemn way. It's difficult. And this year in the diaspora, in the United States, in New York, you know, the Independence Day parade is going to be a security challenge.
Yeah.
And it's going to call out certainly a great number of demonstrators against it. It's going to be a conflict, very different. But here's what I think about both Pesach and Yom HaTzmaut. I was at my own Seder, and I was recalling that 40-some-odd years ago, I was an emissary from Israel dealing with the refuseniks in the Soviet Union. I was an emissary to the underground. And we had a Seder then behind closed doors with the windows shut. And we knew we didn't have much time before the KGB broke in and broke up the Seder and arrested people.
Ooh.
And so we began running through the Seder as quickly as possible. They broke in, huge thugs. Actually, they arrested me. They arrested my partner. And carried us away, and everyone, as we were being led down the staircase, all the families were at the Seder, stood on the landing and sang HaTikvah.
Mm. And Where was this?
This was in 1981 in Odessa.
Wow.
And we were carted away to the KGB, you know, more on that later. But we were able to celebrate Passover even basically in Soviet captivity, where there were 3 million Jews captured, you know.
Unbelievable.
Not free, behind the Iron Curtain. And we have celebrated Passover, say, after the Yom Kippur War, where there were Jews in captivity in Syria and Egypt. There have always been Jews in captivity in one way or the other. And it's very important for us to be, almost it's an obligation for us to celebrate freedom. Not because we have it and others don't, but because to celebrate the fact that there are certainly today, there's a sovereign Jewish state in our ancestral homeland, and not lose sight of the true miracle of that, and be thankful for it, Even though the sovereign Jewish state makes some pretty severe mistakes, but we'd rather have the ability to make mistakes than not have the ability to make mistakes. And I feel the same way about Yom HaTzmaut. That we really are obliged. We have a moral imperative to celebrate. As difficult as it is, maybe even hard to celebrate, but we must. And because to not celebrate gives Hamas and other enemies a victory. They've taken away our celebration, and we shouldn't let them do that.
Oh. So that's how you think will be the celebration this year?
It'll be my celebration. And there's something about our resilience, our strength as a people, that even in the worst circumstances, we can celebrate.
You know, I think there are two things about being Jewish. One is that we know how to celebrate when we, like, that's what we do, celebrate our holidays. But also we're very good in remembering. And I think that these two abilities, that's the clash that we have here. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we were born to remember. That's what Jews do. We remember. The Egyptian, you know, our exile. Remember being being slaves in Egypt. We mm-hmm. remember, we remember, we remember. That's what we do. We remember the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. We remember. And then at the same time, we know how to, like, we continue celebrating throughout the Jewish year. We have the dates that we celebrate and we do it, and that's part of being a Jew. And I think that the celebrating the dates along the year together with remembering, I think that's what makes it very, very hard, because these two instincts, so, or like intuitions,
right,
and like our history, that's what we do. And suddenly they're both clashing. And I think it's very hard for people. And I think that we saw at this Passover that people were trying, you know, trying to think how to do it the right way, how to, people said, we're not celebrating Pesach, we are having Pesach, or something like that.
Or we had a place, like I had a place, yeah, at my Seder table that was left empty.
That was left. Or with, a cup with a, of
with,
wine.
A cup of wine, was, or yeah, with a poster of, yeah, of one of the, yeah, hostages.
Yeah.
And other, you know, symbols of the hostages.
Yeah.
Yes, and we also read a prayer for the hostages.
Yeah.
We read a poem for the hostages. We took time off from, yeah, the Seder to talk about,
talk about the hostages. Hostages.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that just about everybody did this.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone did that.
Yeah.
So you didn't really celebrate Israeli Independence Day as a little kid, right? You don't remember?
I'm thinking back and no. But I grew up very assimilated, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I read my bar mitzvah in transliteration.
Okay.
I mean it. I wouldn't have known what the Talmud was, what Kashrut was, but my family was very Zionist.
Very Zionist, but you
and
didn't
even
celebrate.
Then, that was not, not a notion. Something, I think only later, again, when I was a teenager and got involved in, you know, Zionist youth movements, that we began to go into, say, New York and join the parade.
So you joined the parade. That's the, yeah, way you celebrated.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you make Aliyah.
And I came on, I learned about Yom HaZikaron on Memorial Day. I didn't know anything was about it. And I learned about even Holocaust Day, Holocaust Memorial Day. I was a lone soldier, and I'll never forget, I was home on a leave living in Jerusalem and trying to get some sleep, because in those days you didn't sleep in the army. And all of a sudden the sirens went off. And I went running downstairs.
Oh my God.
Because in those days, they didn't have a local, you know, you had to go, you had a community, this was in Katamon, didn't, you had a community bomb shelter, walking down, and
no
everyone's standing.
There. Everyone's standing, no one's going.
And what's going on here?
Oh my God. Oh, and I don't, can't believe it.
It was Yom HaShoah. And I mean, I had made the Aliyah and gone into the army 2 months later. So it's not as if I had had a big like experience with Israeli society. And I was so humiliated. I was so, so ashamed of myself. But that's how alien it was to me.
Wow. You didn't even know that there
didn't
was
even
a
know
siren.
The sirens. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I never told anybody that story.
No, it's a great
it's a terrible story.
But yeah, it's a great story, because, yeah, it's exactly like the, yeah, you know, in the United States, obviously you knew about the Holocaust and, right, you knew about, you know, remembering the Holocaust. You probably talked about the Holocaust and Leila said, you know, on the Seder or whatever. It was part of your life. But then coming to Israel and you have no idea how Israelis like the, about the Holocaust Memorial Day and what we do.
Mm. And there was another big challenge for me as ambassador in Washington on Holocaust Memorial Day. That is, they say it's the four most important minutes of your year is the speech you give in the Capitol rotunda to most of Congress and most administration. They come there for a ceremony.
On the Holocaust Memorial Day.
Uh-huh. And the ambassador gives the speech. And I had to think about this speech every year and what I was going to say. And every year I had to prevent myself from screaming. Because what I couldn't say was, you, all of you, this building, this Capitol, did nothing to save European Jewry. And this should be not a day of remembrance for America, but a day of atonement, of getting up, standing up and saying, I'm sorry. And I never hear anybody in Washington say, we're sorry for doing nothing.
Do you remember the Day of Independence when you were an ambassador?
Yeah. Then, there we had a big celebration. We had a memorial ceremony.
Yeah. Who came to the memorial ceremony?
Well, first of all, my own family is a bereaved family. We had a close family member killed in a bus bombing in Jerusalem. So it was a very personal event for us. So we had two events on Yom HaZikaron, on Memorial Day. One was a general event, and many people from the community came. About 1,000 people would come, but there were a lot of Israelis living in the Washington area, and they would come, and it would be at a synagogue, and I would give a speech in Hebrew. It was the only speech I gave in Hebrew all year.
Wow.
It was interesting. And it was a military, sort of a mamlachti,
yeah,
national ceremony we had. But then we also had a personal ceremony.
But one came from the administration. Like, it's something local. It's something.
No, that's more. That's yeah, Independence Day. This is the Memorial Day.
Oh.
Then we had a more intimate Memorial Day for bereaved families. Mm. And there's an extraordinary number of bereaved families. I mean, bereaved families going back to the 1948 War of Independence. Wow. And people would get up there and tell stories about their loved ones who had fallen in battle or had been killed in terrorist attacks. Yeah. In our case, killed in terrorist attack. Then we would have we would rent out a big hall and invite all of Washington. And we usually have a representative of the administration there. I think most recently they had Kamala Harris come and give a speech, the vice president.
Memorial Day.
Yeah. So one year we had Rahm Emanuel come.
Independence Day. Yeah.
And that's a great celebration with, everyone, all the military people come in their uniforms and a certain amount of foreign services, like the Russians come in uniform.
Mm.
They have a uniform for their foreign service. So it's very nice. And that's a big event. That's a big event. It takes a year in the planning.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder what they'll do this year.
I don't know. I think that they should hold the celebration. They should. They should.
Yeah.
Again, not to celebrate is to give Hamas a victory.
Yeah.
Don't let them take away our gratitude for independence.
Mike Herzog, the ambassador, I'm sure he's thinking very carefully about this. He's a very wise.
He is. I have a very high opinion of him.
Me too. And how do you think the American Jewish community, I'm thinking about the relationship with Israel, like they suddenly, I think that what we started with the Declaration of Independence about like Jewish and Israeli, right? That's something that goes through the entire Declaration of Independence, that it's a moment that Jewish and Israeli are together. Okay. And I wonder how do you think the American Jewish community, how do they perceive it? How can they perceive it? How do you deal with the fact that your identity, and identity is something that's very important for people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are a few aspects of many American Jewish, American Jews, like two identities that are suddenly clashing. On the one hand, this very important notion of tikkun olam, and being part of the people that do good in the world. And these demonstrations are trying to be perceived as, very pro-peace demonstrations or demonstrations that are trying to like very similar to the Vietnam demonstrations kind of, right? And don't bring cops on campus. And I think that a lot of ideas that not only American Jewish community identify with, I think a lot of people in Israel identify with in the usual world, right? Mm-hmm. You don't bring cops on campus. I understand that, right? That's something I wouldn't want when I studied Hebrew U. I won't want them to bring, and they never brought cops. And then at the same time, it's suddenly towards us and against, our identity and our rights. And I think this is something that's very challenging for a lot of Jews.
Huge. Let me preface my remarks by saying, in my historical studies of the May 14th, 1948, there were great debates over what was in this document. Well, it wasn't in the document. We're going to have the name of God, not have the name of God, rock and redeemer. But there was also a big debate over the name of the country.
Yeah.
And there were some names, some of them quite interesting. But one of the names floated was Yudah.
Yeah.
Judah. Now, if Ben-Gurion had chosen Judah over Israel, then we would have had Christian Jews and Muslim Jews and Bedouin Jews and Druze Jews in this country, because what is Yehudi? It's someone who lives in Judah. Right?
Wow.
Right, think about that. If we had a different name here and not Israel, and it wasn't an obvious name, Israel historically was the kingdom that broke off and kind of disappeared. It's just a thought there for you. I spent a lot of time since October 7th in the United States, entirely too much. I visited something in the vicinity of 40 communities across the United States. I'm going again in another 2 weeks. And what I encountered were two phenomena. One is the part of the community that says, okay, this is not about me. It's about those Jews. The wicked son. It's not about me. It's about you. I don't want anything to do with this. Some of them went so far as to join like Jewish Voices of Peace and other organizations that are anti-Zionist and to lend a veneer of legitimacy to the anti-Semitic protests. But the bulk of the community was a community in profound shock, trauma. I mean, they looked in shock. how do we deal with this? It's undermining everything we thought. Yes, particularly, you know, in the liberal congregations for whom, for which Tikkun Olam became a kind of a religion,
yeah,
a universalist religion, which clashed, you know, with Jewish particularism. You know, if you have a dollar bill, do you give it to your Jewish day school, or do you give it to UNICEF? That's the big, really, what it comes down to.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden, having the foundations of their assumptions about American Jewish life being pulled out from them in a very profound way, especially since most of them are liberal and vote for the Democratic Party. And here you had the administration on many occasions basically accusing Israel of war crimes and increasing anti-Semitism in the United States. If someone had done this with an American, if a Muslim had killed a Muslim in Afghanistan and people got angry at Muslims living in Minnesota, they'd call it Islamophobia.
Of course.
But here, there were, say, Jews who were killing Palestinians, and people were taking out on the Jews in Minnesota. No one was saying that was anti-Semitic. It was fundamentally anti-Semitic. So much so that many of the communities I visited, individuals stood up and said to me, "You in Israel are increasing anti-Semitism in this country by treating the Palestinians so barbarously." They had internalized the arguments, yeah, of the anti-Semites, okay? and legitimized them. So you have part of the community that breaks away, but the bulk of the community, I think, stood shoulder to shoulder with Israel, united with Israel. The level of giving, Rachel, was off the charts.
Unbelievable.
Off the charts.
Unbelievable.
I don't want to say the name of the organization. I helped raise some money for a very worthwhile organization. We went off, I guess, at the end of October with the goal of raising $30 million. And I said, we'd never raise $30 million. Not, you know, never in a gazillion years. We raised 90. And that was just the beginning. And that was just, wow, the beginning. People just emptied out their pockets. I mean, Federation raised, you know, close to $1 billion.
I know.
And so what are they doing? This is actually bringing the Jewish people together with Israeliness. And that was an extraordinary moment. I don't know how long that moment lasts. And there's a constant erosion. Without getting into too many politics here, you know, our current government is not one that is particularly palatable to a large number of American Jews. So that's, yeah, also an issue. They are supporting us in many cases in spite of the government.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
And so that's going to be a challenge, is if, you know, the government remains in power and continues certain policies.
And it's interesting because Herzl, he basically invented Zionism, okay? Like, all of our Zionism comes from Herzl. He was one of the
first. Jewish state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in his book, Altneuland, like the old new country, he talks about the fact that there are Arab minorities and they're part of the Jewish state.
Right.
And everything's okay. Mm-hmm. And we work together and we have trust with each other and they're part of the government and they're part of our politics and they're in the Supreme Court and they're everywhere, which, by the way, mostly they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because Zionism has always been very democratic. Zionism never perceived itself as different than universal ideas. And even more so, when Zionism started, like 120, 25, whatever, 100 and something years ago, Zionism was the universal part of Judaism, basically. It was the democratic part. It was the modern part of Judaism.
Egalitarian,
right?
Part.
Egalitarian.
Yes.
Yeah, it was part of coming to a country, starting your own country, and being part of, as you read in the Declaration of Independence, as we read, to be part of the family of nations. So Zionism wasn't supposed to be the opposite of universalism. Zionism from day one was very, very democratic. Women got the right to vote in the third Zionist Congress. We're second only to New Zealand. Okay, from day one, there wasn't anyone, when the State of Israel was born, there was no group that had to campaign or struggle for the right to vote. Everyone got the right to vote.
In the middle of the War of Independence, we gave the Arabs the right to vote. They're trying to kill us and we gave them the right to vote.
And it was very clear in the middle of the war. I think that's something people need to know. In the middle of a War of Independence, everyone put down their guns and went to vote and continued fighting afterwards. and everyone voted and it was okay. And the Arabs voted. The Arabs were elected and it was... And it's interesting how, you know, from Zionism being something that's like egalitarian and, you know, tikkun olam and this, it became the more particular part. And this is something that it's interesting because it's not obvious how this happened.
But it's built into Judaism because we are, on one hand, the nation that dwells alone, and we're also a light unto nations. So that tension is built in, hardwired into Jewish identity, Jewish faith even. And the state of Israel also aspired, on one hand, you know, to drain the swamps and make the desert bloom and absorb immigration. But from our earliest days in the 1950s, 1960s, what did we do? We extended aid to the emerging countries of Africa.
From the very beginning. We had nothing from the very beginning.
So yeah. it is hardwired into us. It's hardwired, you know, in the rescue teams from the IDF that go out and help disaster
victims.
It's in and nobody questions it. No one questions, say, hey, why are we spending this money to dig people out of the rubble in countries that don't even like us.
Yeah, right? Turkey.
I was thinking Turkey. They don't even like us.
Yeah.
Okay. Why are we doing this?
Because we're very proud that we do it.
It's who we are.
Yeah.
It's who we are. And let's take it to today. Okay, we're fighting a brutal, brutal war against a genocidal organization in Gaza that's using its own population as human shields, using Gaza itself as a shield because of the tunnels under it. A population that voted for Hamas. Of Amazonian that, you know, cheered every time Hamas shelled us, that beat and spat upon every hostage, and God knows what else they did, okay? And many people in the United States, not necessarily Jews, come up to us and say, well, the United States would have just flattened the place on the first day. We would have sent over the B-1, B-2 bombers, and there wouldn't be a brick on a brick, and we'd kill, you know, a couple hundred thousand people, and it'd be over in a day. Why didn't you do that? And there's a certain answer that says, well, we can't do this because of, you know, we're a small state that's very dependent on the United States and we're internationally dependent. I don't even think, tell me if I'm wrong, if someone had given the order on October 8th to do this, I'm not sure we would have done that.
No, I agree with you.
I'm not sure that it's
us to
do that.
I agree with you.
And so it's not about the Palestinians, it's about us.
Yeah.
It's about our identity and who we are as a Jewish state. I was always in government because I dealt with diplomacy a lot. I was very much in favor of always acting as a Jewish and democratic state, which we didn't always do. Sometimes we acted as, you know, just any other country.
Yeah.
Well, the big example would be the Ukraine, where I thought that our neutrality was sort of morally wrong and also strategically wrong.
I agree.
Because we can't be like any other state. We are the Jewish and democratic state. We have to act like that internationally.
This is a moment that maybe we can we're coming together because we have we feel we have no other choice because of what's happening in the United States and what's happening in Israel. But maybe this can also be a moment that we can crystallize and study together and figure out how do we redefine this relationship. And if Zionism started off as like the universal, more universal aspect of Judaism and more modern and liberal aspect of Judaism, and today it's perceived in the United States the other way around. I wonder, you know, this is something that if we talk about and if we study, maybe we can rethink it.
It's going to be difficult in the United States now because any kind of discussion in the United States is the political polarization is so deep. I want to go back to talking about democracy in Israel, though, because it also has a functional capacity. Because we are a multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multilingual, right, society, democracy is basically the only way we can get anything done in this place. And that was also one of the origins of the democratic structure of the Yishuv, the pre-state community, because nobody came from a democratic tradition. It's not like we have the Magna Carta, you know, in our background. We either came from Eastern Europe, Russia, or we came from North Africa and the Middle East, and there's no big deep democratic roots.
We don't have deep democratic roots from the countries we came from, but I think that we're all used to arguing, our Talmud is arguing, our Mishnah is arguing, and also in shuls. I haven't met one shul that doesn't have arguments all the time.
I'm laughing because we've got a lot of arguments.
Yeah, and that's what we do. Like, we argue and they say this and this and that, and then you have to find a way to make it work together.
My line, whenever I go talking, I give just two Hasbara public diplomacy lines. One is that there's a very short list of countries in the world that have never known a second of democratic rule. Very short. That's the United States, Britain, a couple of islands in the Pacific. We're on that list.
Yeah.
And we've never known a second of non-democratic governance. But what makes us unique is we've never known a second of peace. Hmm. Nobody comes close to that record. We never get respect for this. Secondly, I talk about the call-up of the reserves, of 360,000 reserves.
That's unbelievable.
That is the equivalent, proportionally, of 20 million Americans.
That's unbelievable.
It's more Americans held than served in all of World War II. And who were these people, you know?
Just everyone.
They were everyone. The people
everyone.
Fathers and brothers and sons who left their families, left it to go off and fight for their country. You don't see that. You know, who in Belgium is willing to fight for Belgium anymore? And who's willing to fight for Spain, really? This is Israelis who want to go out and fight and also to die for their country. That's no small thing. And we have to appreciate both this, the fact that we have been unremittingly democratic and willing to fight for that democracy, in which very, very few countries in the world are willing to do that today. And we have to appreciate that. And I think that's a message for our Independence Day. These are
Zionism,
the things we have to celebrate.
Judaism, democracy, we believe they go together.
They go together.